On this week's 51%, we hear from an author about the experience of young Black and brown girls in school.
What we know is that girls who are pushed away from school are in greater likelihood of participating in underground economies or getting involved in activities that can render them vulnerable to contact with the juvenile court and criminal legal system.
And the Army turns to gaming for new recruits, enlisting at least one woman during a recent event. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. In 2016, Dr. Monique Morris examined the experience of Black and brown girls in school with her book, Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. We brought to you Bob Barrett's interview with her about Push Out when the book came out. Now, Morris is back with a further exploration of the experience of young girls of color in school with her follow-up called Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, Education for the Liberation of Black and Brown Girls. 51%'s Bob Barrett spoke with Morris about her new book and the title's meaning.
The title emerged organically from the material, I think, as I was starting to compile the narratives and thinking about what might drive a pedagogy for educational practices that really center around healing and learning. I started to think about the traditions in Black and brown communities that have functioned in that capacity. And so as I started to think about it and started to write about it, it just sort of emerged that Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues should be guiding our approach to, at least the approach to reading what it is that I have to say, if not how we approach education altogether.
We spoke a few years ago about your last book, Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. What have you been up to since then, and how did it result in this book?
Yeah, so with Push Out, a lot has occurred since Push Out. I think when I first wrote Push Out, I was trying to beat a drum to get people to pay attention to a critical issue that, for many, is still a relatively new idea that Black girls are disproportionately experiencing school discipline, and that it should be, the understanding of that phenomenon should be situated in a historical narrative about misrepresentations of Black girlhood. And since that time, I've been moving around the country, speaking with different communities. I have visited countless communities and schools, talking with educators about the material. And actually, in the course of having that conversation, that's when I discovered not only were people aware that this was a growing phenomenon and interested, increasingly interested in being a part of the community that responds to it, but that there were schools that were doing great work already with Black and brown girls to try to interrupt these cycles of violence in their lives. And so from that work, from the touring with Push Out, came Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, Education for the Liberation of Black and Brown Girls, where I profile some of those practices in schools and people who have been so instrumental in shifting the trajectory of the narrative for Black and brown girls.
Black and brown girls come into school, as you say, at a disadvantage anyway, it seems. Can schools actually fix this? Should they?
I think that schools, well, first and foremost, you know, I established in Push Out, and, you know, the data continue to represent this as a truth, is that, you know, education is a critical protective factor against contact with the juvenile court or criminal legal system. And so if we're going to understand education to perform in that critical capacity, then we have to be intentional about how we build out schools as locations for healing so that they can be locations for learning. That's one of the critical reasons I call it freedom work education. I think education is a part of how we facilitate freedom, how we support the capacity for one to have agency in her life, and for us to think about how we really operationalize that practice on a daily basis. So I'm not asking for schools to become hospitals when I say that schools should be locations for healing. What I'm asking is for schools to understand their function as one that is central to our articulation of freedom, and in doing so, to explore the ways in which we have created structures, practices, and a way of thinking about young people that place them at greater risk of contact with the juvenile court or criminal legal system rather than reducing that risk. And so in the critical examination of our practices, the invitation is for schools to see themselves as a place where young people can go, where they can actualize what young people ask for anyway. When I ask them what they want in a school, they say they want their school to be a sanctuary. And so the invitation is for us to think about how we can really build out practices in schools that support that.
It's interesting that you spoke to a group of students in Alabama and asked them to imagine school without police, and they, I don't know if they couldn't do it or didn't want to do it.
Yeah, I don't know either. But it was a critical moment in my research. I was working with my colleague at the Georgetown Center on Poverty and Inequality, and we were doing the research for a toolkit that we ended up writing on school resource officers and girls of color. It was clear that the school resource officers that are in our schools and law enforcement in our schools have little to no training at all on how to engage with girls of color, what critical issues are, how they can be responsive to some of these issues to the extent that they're in school. I should say that the toolkit is not an invitation for there to be law enforcement in schools. In fact, in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, I clearly say that I don't think that safety needs a police escort. I think that what we need to do is foster the conditions that facilitate actual safety, not the implementation or introduction of instruments of surveillance, including those who are agents of it. And so, you know, the conversation I had with the girls was really about how we've been priming our children to think that without the presence of law enforcement, they cannot have safety. I asked them to imagine schools without police in it, and many of them could not. I've gone into college campuses where I talk to students about their learning experiences, and many of the students of color will raise their hands when I ask if they had police in schools, and the white students don't. And it's really interesting how this begins to play out across the landscape of our educational systems, but also really in terms of what that does to, like I said before, a priming for young people to believe that their learning can't take place outside of a structure of surveillance. This is, you know, part of the narrative that has followed children of color for a very long time, where they are seen to need discipline, but their counterparts don't necessarily have that same narrative following their educational journeys. And as a result, there is this way in which there is a reading of behaviors, a response to those behaviors that doesn't recognize some of the core issues associated with negative student behaviors, traumas, adverse childhood experiences that we now map through very helpful instruments, but rather, you know, just a criminalizing effect that says these are kids that are disposable, as opposed to these are kids who can learn from a restorative practice and an opportunity to repair relationships and acknowledge the harm and respond to that harm so that they can move forward with their lives.
And you cite a study in the book where it says that black girls are seen to need less nurturing. They're almost seen as adults by the time they're 10.
Yeah, one of the underlying factors for how we respond to young people is this emergent, or one of the things informing how we respond to young people is this emergent research on adultification in black girls. The study I'm citing is the Georgetown Center on Poverty and Inequality study that examined adultification and found that black girls experience this reading of their behaviors as more adult-like when they're as young as 5 years old, and it peaks when they're between the ages of 10 and 14, which means that adults are seeing children, black girls, and responding to them as if they need less protection, less nurturing, less comforting, that they are believed to know more about adult subjects such as sex. And this can lead then to them having less patience with them, having harsher responses with them in their learning spaces. This perception that young people are older than they are means that we engage them as if they should be in greater control of their behaviors. And so this is an important part of the research that is developing in our narrative around how we respond to young people, because ultimately we need to see educators to see these children as children. And so when, you know, in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, and in the documentary film, Push Out, that is based upon Push Out and Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, I try to explore how we can, I guess, more rigorously examine our own biases when we're talking about and interacting with black girls, but also to think about how then we develop structures that respond to them and support their well-being so that they are successful in school, not despite the conditions in these spaces, but because of these conditions.
Coming into this book, I knew you were not a fan of suspensions, and you certainly do acknowledge that in this book, too. What can be done with school discipline beyond suspensions?
Yeah, a lot can be done beyond suspensions. One of the things that I said in my TED Talk was that it's important for us to see that when young people get in trouble, we should be bringing them in closer, not pushing them away. The doctrine in our society is often to ostracize or remove people who cause harm, and without there really being a concrete understanding or conversation about accountability. And so we conflate accountability with punishment. I think it's important for us to think about how we repair harms in our society, how we address, especially with young people who are learning, children and adolescents who are still learning, whose brains are still developing, how we teach them to deal with conflict and how we teach our communities to respond when there is a hurt. Instead of suspensions, many schools, which I document in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, are thinking about the development of a full, robust continuum of alternatives, like restorative practices that can be multiple modalities. The most popular one is the circle that schools are using to engage young people in conversations about what the harm was that was committed, how they repair the harm, and who's responsible for repairing that harm. This is based on indigenous practices that, you know, have facilitated repair in many, many communities for generations. Schools are implementing mindfulness practices to help center students. They are implementing a host of practices around advocacy and school-based relationship building that can respond to the traumas that usually lead young people to act out in class or to be disruptive in their learning spaces. You know, ultimately, this is about co-constructing a climate that responds to young people where they need to have that response targeted, as opposed to just saying this is a negative behavior and responding to that behavior without consideration for all of the conditions that will allow that harm to fester and grow and spread into the community of schools and learning.
There are so many incidents you cite in the book, but there was one experience you had at a restorative justice event in Rochester, New York. I wish you'd tell us about, because it made a big impression on me.
Yeah, it made a big impression on me, too. That's why I wrote about it. I was upstate in New York, and I was at a restorative justice conference. And I was getting ready to prepare. I was a keynote speaker for that conference, and a woman came in and asked me to sign her book, but she also, you know, when she asked if I would sign her book, she asked me to sign her criminal conviction history, and it was a thick packet, about 25 pages of harm that she had committed and that she recognized was related to her own push-out story. What we know is that girls who are pushed away from school are in greater likelihood of participating in underground economies or getting involved in activities that can render them vulnerable to contact with the juvenile court and criminal legal system. It's another reason why we recognized the value of education in interrupting that cycle. She was there with her niece, who was on a 5-day suspension, and so in, you know, many ways following the same path that she recognized as harmful in her own life. And she asked me to sign her conviction history. And initially, I didn't want to do it because, you know, I looked at this document and documentation of harm and didn't want to put my name on it. But then I realized that what she was telling me in asking me to sign that was that she understood push-out at a visceral, innate level. And she had lived it. That her way of understanding push-out and her way of responding to the material that I had written in that book was to say, this is something that comes from when our girls are pushed out, so we have to stop this. She understood it. She understood what I was saying. She lived what I was saying, and she wanted me to understand that. And so I signed it, but I signed that she was so much more than this, because I could tell from her engagement with me that this was a reflection of harms that had happened to her and that she had reproduced in many ways because there had not been that focus on the healing in her early childhood and adolescence. And then she hugged me, and I hugged her back. And I think in that embrace, you find the opportunities for healing that I want to extend into schools. And it's not just this utopian touchy-feely moment. It is an opportunity for us to think about how we build out human connections, how we teach with those connections, and how we build an infrastructure of learning that is fundamentally based upon the development of those kinds of relationships so that young people can be who they are intended to be, rather than this construction of criminality that we turn them into.
I just thought that inscription was perfect. That was so well done.
Thank you.
You talked about there are a lot of good programs going on around the country. There's one I like to talk about, which is kind of in your backyard in Oakland. The Unified School District has the African American Female Excellence Program. Could you talk about that? What are they doing there?
Yes. So Oakland Unified School District a few years ago became one of the few school districts to have a dedicated position in the district focused on the achievement of African American girls. And the work that they are doing includes culturally specific workshops, it includes mentorship, it includes an annual conference, but it also provides an opportunity for the girls in the district to take on leadership positions and fellowships, internships, to advance the narrative about what girls need to feel whole and to feel that their needs are being responded to in schools. And so the African American Female Excellence Initiative, which was actually named by girls in the district, really seeks to uplift in many ways some of the critical issues impacting black girls, but also building out an infrastructure to respond to them through a broader narrative of equity and justice in the district. And I think it's a great example of how districts can respond to specific populations using a culturally relevant engagement that is co-constructed and participatory in nature, and that absolutely provides opportunities for there to be a critical examination of issues that are impacting our girls. Many programs around the country, or many districts around the country, have initiatives in place for boys, young men of color and boys of color, without apology. But there are fewer programs, really just a handful, that focus on our girls. New York is another one. I didn't write about it in the book because it hadn't been established yet, but they now have adopted the My Sister's Keeper effort. And so I'm excited by the movement to say that our schools do have to be responsive to some of the unique conditions, especially when we see that our girls continue to be impacted by these racial disparities in a way that requires us to explore how we can better respond to our girls.
Could be frustrating for some girls who have this great program and the very next school district might have nothing.
Exactly. It's very frustrating. I hear about it all the time. And, you know, the important thing is for us to explore what we might take from these existing programs and initiatives and spread it as widely as possible. Much of what I talk about in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues and in my work overall are practices that impact how we think about our girls and how we implement and engage in the practice of teaching as, you know, a partner in this learning experience. That I think it really doesn't have to do with money and the development of initiatives as much as it has to do with a committed exploration of how we are engaging our young people and how we can build out new systems and structures that are more responsive to their needs. It's one of the reasons I write these books, because I'm hopeful that people will take them and see what can be done, not just to treat the book as a one-read experience and say, oh, I saw this film or I read this book, but to really think about how they can use this as a tool to build out their own practices, regardless of whether there is a structured program. Obviously, the structured programs are best because there is a system of accountability and a point person who is driving it, and, you know, a way that we can mobilize around that work to support our girls. And much more needs to happen around investments in our girls, where we still see there being an underrepresentation in the resources that are allocated to explore their experiences in this conversation about educational justice.
It's interesting, an incident you talked about in Nashville where, in the end, some of the girls were just saying they would like more black teachers. They would like better relationships with their teachers. They'd like to hear more about the black experience than just slavery.
Yeah. It's important to recognize that in our discussions about trauma, I doubt if we have time to really get into this part, but one of the things that I try to elevate in the book is that when we talk about trauma, we often talk about incidents that have occurred without recognition of the historical trauma that is associated with a disenfranchised grief that many black students, really, I would argue all black students in schools, experience, regardless of whether it's a public, private, charter, et cetera, school. It's important to recognize that when our girls are experiencing discussions about, especially, you know, in the humanities and social sciences, they have this, but also in the STEM fields as well, they have this erasure of their experiences or this rendering of their experience in a way that really does trigger historical traumas, where their ancestors are referred to as property, where their experiences as the descendants of those who are survivors of the African slave trade are seen as sort of secondary to the core issues that are taught in schools, that they're not really in a space where they can approach these difficult topics with a degree of dignity, and that that is triggering, that they feel that people mishandle that information, that there are opportunities for us to think about how we better train our educators to be a part of those conversations, but also how we diversify the teaching profession so that individuals from multiple backgrounds are teaching the children from multiple backgrounds that are before them. That it's really important to recognize that much of this work is about increasing the capacity of any educator who steps into the classroom. I do believe that most educators enter this field not to cause harm, that they are in this field because they believe in the promise of children and have and understood the value of education and are passionate about it. But teaching is hard work, and so a lot of educators either fall victim to their own biases or have not done the rigorous hard work to explore what those biases are before they step into this classroom or this practice and work of teaching. And so it is important that the girls themselves, you know, are saying that they want to have teachers that look like them, that can teach them about their experiences, when and even if they don't look like them or come from, you know, similar backgrounds, they want to have educators who demonstrate that they care about them and that they are not going to erase their experiences in the practice of sharing knowledge.
Well, quickly, let's get into the film. What's that all about, and how did that come about?
Well, the film is, like I said, based upon the two books, and it's a partnership between me and Women in the Room Productions to basically tell the story of Push Out and try to introduce this topic to folks who may not have otherwise been aware that this is a phenomenon that's occurring. In the film, we do profile some of the individuals who are also profiled in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, and you know, talk pretty intentionally and descriptively about what the push-out phenomenon is and how it impacts girls and young women into their adulthood. And so we are moving throughout the country with limited screenings. We've been screening since September 12th. We launched the world premiere of the documentary at the Congressional Black Caucus with Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, and we have been working to share the information throughout the country.
That was Dr. Monique Morris speaking with 51%'s Bob Barrett. She is co-founder of the National Black Women's Justice Institute. Her latest book is Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, Education for the Liberation of Black and Brown Girls. As the Army works to reach its recruiting goals, it has found that video games are one of the best ways to attract new soldiers, men and women. Increasingly, the military is holding e-sports events, and it's finding they're often more effective than traditional recruiting methods like visiting high schools or sending out brochures. From Denver, Colorado, Taylor Allen reports for the American Homefront Project.
Call of Duty Modern Warfare is one of the most anticipated video game releases of the fall.
The rules of engagement have changed.
The game leads players through military missions and combat.
If you can't identify the target, you are the target.
So, it makes sense that Army recruiters picked this game to be the centerpiece of a recent recruiting event at an esports arena in Lakewood, a suburb outside of Denver. It's a dark room the size of a warehouse, lit mainly by the glow from rows and rows of computer screens. The people playing wear headphones. You hear the excited chatter of players and controllers clicking. Anyone who came to the game's release party was able to play the new game, as long as they also spoke to Army recruiters.
This is the targeted, you know, demographic, you know, these young men and women that come out here to play the esports.
Sergeant Vincent Cruz is a recruiter. He says video games are a way for the Army to connect with more people. It even started a professional esports team, which has become part of his pitch.
Reach out to these men and women and show them actually, hey, you can actually do this in the Army and get paid, by the way.
The Army has been struggling to attract new soldiers. Last year, it fell 6,000 troops short of its national recruiting goal. This year, the Army set a lower goal and met it. But Crew says the old ways to attract potential recruits just aren't working the way they used to.
Phone calls and, you know, text messages is not you know, the way to go. Traditionally, that's how we've been trying to reach out to the population. For here, it's very difficult, you know what I mean? So now it's more like the Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat.
The Army says it's opened 44 virtual recruiting stations that are trying to reach potential soldiers through social media and texts. And it calls its esports efforts some of the highest lead-generating events in the history of the all-volunteer force.
Do it!
Across the gaming arena, 17-year-old Gavin Gaines is sitting at one of the computers, staring at the bright screen. How is he doing so far?
I've died like 4 times in 3 missions, so not gonna say greatest.
Gaines says he isn't ready for college yet, and he's about 95% sure he wants to go to the military. A big reason for him is community.
It's always just kind of been a big motivator for me, is just kind of like having somewhere where I belong. I like the military because it's like, you may not even necessarily like everyone, but it's like, you know, they have your back type of thing.
Out of about 110 people that attended the esports event, the military says it gained 35 leads. Michelle Alcantar is also 17 and a brand new recruit. She'll graduate in December, and by the summer, she's off to boot camp in Oklahoma. She got into video games through her brother-in-law, who's also in the Army. Call of Duty is a favorite. Both gaming and the military are stereotypically guy things, but she's proud to be a woman doing both of them.
To me, it's really special because not a lot of women, I feel like, are represented in the Army, and I feel like it's such a power move for women just because, like, we can do the same thing men can, and we're finally allowed to do that after I know that years that we couldn't.
Alcantar also ended up winning a raffle that night. She went home with a copy of the new game for Xbox, but she didn't say whether she'll take it to boot camp with her. In Denver, I'm Taylor Allen.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1587.